Jeff Perlman is with us, and again, we're talking about his book. It's called Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton. We're making it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline USA Book Corner. And Jeff, tell me a little bit how you would characterize the off-field life of Walter Payton.
Guarded, shy. Well, maybe shy is not the right word. Very guarded, very protected. Did not like people knowing his business. You know, kept a very, very, very tight circle of friends. You know, he would go to dinner with teammates. He would occasionally have teammates over to his house, but he was not a guy who was going to throw parties and hang out with everyone on the road. And he was very protective of who he was. And, you know, was not the best husband, you wouldn't say. I mean, like a lot of guys in sort of professional sports, wasn't the most loyal husband out there. Certainly had his women in different cities and definitely was a player. I mean, when he started his career, he was sort of this quiet, devoutly religious Bible study, you know, before every game. And he kind of strayed away from that over time. Again, as a lot of guys do, is sort of they get eaten up a little bit by the bright lights. He was very, very image conscious. I mean, very image conscious. Everything. He had one of the most famous Jerry Curl haircuts of his era, you know, right up there with, the Soul Glow from Coming to America. And, you know, he had to look good. I always had sort of diamond bracelets. His pants, there was never a wrinkle. These, you know, beautiful for the time sweaters. He drove insanely fancy cars. He was a big hunter. He loved to go on these hunting trips. He loved to hunt with a bow. You know, he really aspired to go bear hunting with a bow, which I don't think he ever did. Interesting, really interesting and funny. He had this weird sense of humor. He could be very off-putting, and people didn't always understand him. And he could actually be sort of sexually intimidating with teammates. He was a guy, he'd come up and pinch you on the butt, or he'd pull your hair, or he'd make an inappropriate comment, and people would be very confused by this. And you know, newcomers to the Bears would be like, what is he doing? And people would just say, that's Walter being Walter. You know, just let it go, that's Walter. So he was a quirky, unique, weird, awkward, funny, off-putting man.
One of the things I find interesting is the dichotomy. He wanted his life to be private, but yet he was doing things that were going to get out. People were going to be seeing him. His wife, Connie, who I've talked to a couple of times, it was interesting. I mean, you talk about it in the book, about the fact that he was married to Connie, he was living in a different house, and also he was dating a flight attendant from New Jersey. I mean, it doesn't seem to make sense to me. Was that one of the dichotomies of him?
Yeah, well, it was strange. I mean, the last 10 years of his life, he wasn't living with his wife, and he could have gotten a divorce. You know, they certainly, you know, it's legal to get a divorce in the state of Illinois, but I know that image was very important to him. You know, he was known as a family man. He was known as a, you know, the charming sort of, you know, happy, you know, family man and husband, loving father. And I'm not saying he wasn't a loving individual, but the image didn't always match the reality. And he needed that image, or felt he needed that image. And I really think it's unfortunate, because it must have been hard. I always think this. I thought this throughout this book. To have to live up to something that you're not, to feel that you have to present an image that isn't entirely true, and that you don't want to let people down. I mean, he didn't want to let people down. He wanted people to sort of believe in Walter Payton. And he didn't want to be sort of found out to be sort of not entirely what he was. And I think that's a hell of a lot of pressure. I compare it almost to someone who's gay and feels like he has to be in the closet and can't tell anyone, and the pressure to not tell anyone, to live this sort of false life and have this false image. I feel like he kind of went through that too, where he just didn't feel that he could tell people that he was a human being with problems and with issues, that he had to keep this sort of mask up of who he was.
You talk about in the book, and this got a lot of play as well, about his induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame and how visibly nervous he was. Tell everybody why he was.
Well, it was a weird time for him. Basically his wife, who again he wasn't living with at the time, but they were still known as the Paytons, was in row one, and his girlfriend, who he had been with for many years and who he loved, was in row two. And he was petrified that this was going to lead to some kind of horrible situation, that it would be really awkward, that somehow it would get out. And he spent his 4 days in Canton basically hiding in a hotel room, avoiding the spotlight. He was being ripped by other Hall of Famers, past Hall of Famers who were there for, how can you not appreciate this? What kind of behavior is this? Very, very difficult for him. And it really ruined his time there. And it's funny, people, people sort of criticize, that's a criticism. They say, well, how can you write about that? You know, this is Walter Payton. How can you write about that? And I really thought it's a pretty profound moment. Here it is. It's supposed to be the greatest sort of time in a football player's life. You're being inducted into the ultimate Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And for 4 days, you are miserable, freaking out, not happy, avoiding your family, you know, putting up a scared front. And I just thought how sad that was and how, you know, how little it was and how it must have been a very miserable time to be him.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm glad that you put that in the book because it is the high of the mountain and the low of the valley that you talk about. Also, there was something else about that Hall of Fame induction. The two women, was that the first time Lita and Connie, his wife, legal wife, is that the first time they had met? And what understanding did they come to?
Well, it was the first time they met. And I think the understanding was, I don't know if necessarily they came to an understanding. I mean, what Connie knew she had existed before then. And certainly the girlfriend knew that he was married. I think it was a very, very sort of awkward, you know, very, very awkward, weird sort of, you know, you're Walter Payton, you're hoping this doesn't happen. You're really hoping this doesn't happen. I really hope they don't meet. And then they meet. And I think it was just a very, very awkward, difficult, horrible time for him.
The other dichotomy that I came upon, we talked a little bit about his relationship with his father, but yet here is a guy that had an out-of-wedlock son that came at about the time his daughter Brittany was born as well, and he never made an effort to see the boy. And really, up until Peyton's illness, his family really never knew anything about the child's existence. Why was he that way?
It's actually the great mystery of Walter Payton. Of all the different things I wrote about, that's one I don't understand. I mean, I understand it in that he felt he had to keep up this image, and that would be a needle to the image. You know, the idea of Walter Payton having an out of wedlock child. But you know, I just heard an interview with him today from back then when he was talking about the greatest days of his life, or the birth of his son and the birth of his daughter. And I don't doubt him. I don't doubt the sincerity of that sentiment. But it's just he did have an ability, I will say, to compartmentalize and to take things he didn't want to think about them and somehow just not think about them, have them not creep into his head. They did not exist. If I don't think about it and I don't deal with it, this does not exist. And he was financially responsible for the son. It wasn't like he dodged that or avoided that. He didn't. But he never dealt with it, and he didn't want to deal with it. And he had other people handle that. You know, here are the financial arrangements. You take care of it. And it's a mystery. It really is, because for all the good traits and all the good things he did, it's definitely not his brightest light.
Jeff, you know as well as I do, when pro athletes, and particularly the great ones, come to the end of their career, it's at a relatively young age, and they get lost sometimes. I mean, they've been disciplined. This will happen on this day, on that day. There is game day and everything. And then all of a sudden, it comes to an abrupt halt, and they really get lost. And that seemed to be the case with Walter Payton, because you write in the book how he struggled with loneliness and depression, threatened suicide on a couple of occasions, and he even became dependent upon laughing gas. That was the one that surprised me. Talk a little bit about his post-playing days and why you think he became lost.
Well, I think, again, after he failed to get the expansion franchise, I don't think he knew what he was going to do. You know, his finances weren't great. He spent a lot of money. He was not a great businessman. You know, he was great in a room. He was great with a room. He was a great speaker, but he was not a great businessman. And I think ideally he would have been sitting on a boat in Mississippi fishing or hunting in the woods and to have the financial stability to be able to do that. And he didn't. He just didn't. And here you are, you're in your, you know, late 30s, early 40s, and you have all these past achievements and you can't do them anymore. You don't have the power to do that anymore. He could not run through the Broncos defense anymore. It wasn't going to happen again. And he never found sort of, he thought owning the team would have been the adrenaline fill-in. You know, he tried auto racing. He took a couple years where he tried making it on different circuits. And it, you know, he almost died in a crash. And that ended that. And he just never found the adrenaline fill. And he was in a lot of pain, as you alluded to. I mean, played 13 years. He missed one game. He was in a lot of pain. And when people have kind of said after the excerpt, you know, they use the term drug addict. And I feel like, I'm not saying it's completely inaccurate, but I feel like it misses the point a little bit. Like, this guy was, you know, needed painkillers because his body was decimated. You know, as much as he you know, dished out the pain, like we talked about, he also took a pounding. He wore very light pads during his career. He wore the flimsiest helmet you could possibly wear. He took a beating. And so here he is at the sort of toward the years before he got sick. His plan for financial stability fell through. Physically, he's a wreck. He isn't, you know, his knees are bone on bone. He was used to a certain lifestyle. He was used to a certain fame. And he just is lacking. His family life isn't great. And he's struggling to find sort of who he is and what he's going to be next. And he just doesn't have the answers.
Did any of your research or does your gut, since you've been around sports for a long time, Jeff, tell you that the fact that he played with that thin helmet and the number of hits that he took being a running back and everything, that he suffered from the concussion syndrome that a lot of players suffer through?
I honestly don't know. I wish I could give you a better answer, and I've been asked that. But, you know, he was cremated after he died, and so they never did any studies on it. And it would be, I mean, you have to, obviously it has to enter your mind as a possibility. But, I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, certainly the Dave Duerson and the Andre Waters, those sort of things make you think about it. But I just don't have a good answer for you.
What was the dependency on laughing gas about? I've never heard that one before.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd say dependency is the right word. When he was with the Bears, he had a Winnebago that he brought to camp, and he would keep a tank of laughing gas in the back, and players would come in and sort of fill little balloons and take hits of the laughing gas to lighten off the load, you know, the physicality. And after he was done playing, he still had the tanks in his garage and would, it's an unusual one, obviously, and would take the hits off of the gas. So an uncommon one, I would say.
What do you think his legacy is, both as a football player and as a man, or is that kind of clouded because most people will only think of him as the football player?
Well, you know, I think as a football player, obviously, his legacy is one of the all-time greats, and arguably the greatest football player to ever play, the most complete football player. This is a guy who was Jackson State's kicker. You know, he could punt a ball 60 yards. He could throw a ball. I mean, he was a gifted athlete and you know, a wonderful player, one of the best ever, if not the best. And I think as a man, honestly, I think his legacy is as the football player who could touch people and who sort of allowed himself to be embraced and who allowed fans to feel like they knew him. You know, he wasn't standoffish. He wasn't guarded. He never, you know, rarely put down opponents. You could walk him up. He wasn't the guy. If you walked up to him while he was eating at a restaurant, he would sign your autograph and give you a smile. You know, he was a guy who the fans of Chicago felt was their own. And I think that's a tremendous legacy, and I think that's a very fair legacy.
We got about 90 seconds left. What would you like the reader to take away from the book, Jeff?
First and foremost, I hope they realize that, you know, a man's sort of, you know, the struggles that a man goes through, a person goes through, those struggles sort of make us who we are. And, you know, Walter Payton, at the end of his life, when he was really struggling and when he was hurting and when he was at Mayo Clinic, you know, he was never on the list to get a liver transplant. There was always this idea that he was on the list. He never had the pager, ever. It was by the time, you know, it quickly became this bile duct cancer. And yet he kept doing public service announcements, and he kept talking about the need for organ donations. And it wasn't going to help him. That, to me, is an amazing legacy. The selflessness of that act, to know you're dying, to know it's not going to help you, but to keep pushing forward, I think is amazing.
In about 30 seconds, are you happy with the way this book came out?
Oh, yeah. This is my favorite book I've written, and I love Walter Payton more now than I ever did when I just knew him as the guy who ran for 275 against the Vikings and broke Jim Brown's record. I think the fact that he was a human being who went through a lot of the same problems we all go through and you know, mostly sort of handle those problems with a certain grace and dignity takes him to an entirely new level in my book.
I got to tell you, Jeff, I was happy to have you on because after reading some of the reviews and some of the things that people had said, I knew there was a different perspective. I had you on before on the Roger Clemens book, and I'm so glad you were on. So people, after hearing your own words and putting it into a proper perspective, I think they'll come away with a more complete picture. Congratulations on the book, and again, thank you for joining us, Jeff, on Sports Byline.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate the forum. I really do.
Jeff Perlman with us. And again, if you want to check out this book, it is a great one. It's called Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.